Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 3, is brought to you by several great sponsors. They include Tripping.com, Stamps.com, Audible's presentation of Ponzi Supernova, and our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that, research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
Back in episode 1, we walked you through the basic timeline for the morning of April 12th, 2015, according to the Baltimore Police Department and widely accepted by the media and the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office. The transport van's 6 stops, beginning with a pickup on Presbury Street and ending at the Western District Station where Freddie Gray was found unresponsive, were revealed to the public slowly, in bits and pieces, seemingly at the same pace as police investigators were learning about them as well. Over the course of the next few episodes, we'll be taking a much closer look at that timeline, reviewing each stop according to the police officers and civilians who were there, and seeing how those accounts jive with the video and audio evidence that's available to us. If you think that sounds like a simple task, think again. Nothing about this case is simple or as it initially appears, especially the timeline and especially the evidence that supposedly corroborates it. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm here with my co-hosts Amelia McDonald-Perry, Justine Barron, and Dr. Marcia Chatlin.
My name is Amelia McDonald-Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
North Avenue and 109.
Mount.
North and Mount. Anybody in the area?
This is Lieutenant Brian Rice alerting a Baltimore police dispatcher that he's engaged in a foot chase with two individuals, seconds after he allegedly made contact with Freddie Gray. When BPD gave their first press conference the day after Freddie Gray was injured, they were vague, even evasive, when addressing why Freddie was in police custody in the first place. They definitely weren't prepared to explain why there was a 45-minute gap between Freddie's arrest and the call for a medic. In fact, BPD was tight-lipped about the timing of anything that happened that morning until April 16th when, as we told you in the first episode, they released their first timeline. While sparse, the timeline did have exact timestamps for the start of the foot chase, Freddie's detainment, the request for a wagon, and the call for a medic. Plus, it revealed the van's second stop for the first time. This new information shrunk the 45-minute gap to 30 minutes. That's strange though, right? The investigators could know, for example, that Freddie was taken into custody at 8:40 and 12 seconds, but seemingly have no clue about what happened during the 30 minutes before a medic was called to Western District. How could BPD have exact timestamps for the first two stops, but no information about what occurred after? Where did those timestamps even come from? Looking back, knowing what we know now, it's obvious. The timestamps match up with calls made between the individual officers and police dispatch. The dispatch audio has never been publicly released, but we have two versions to use as a reference. The first is a montage of calls that was played during the trials, but without timestamps. The second was provided to us by a source. It only has some of the calls, but with timestamps. You've got to wonder why BPD was not forthcoming about the fact that the police radio informed their earliest timeline, but we'll be getting into all of that in our next episode. For now, assume that sometime between April 12th and April 16th, investigators reviewed the audio and decided to disclose at least some of what they had learned. So April 16th is when BPD first shared any specific details about the incident, including Freddie's arrest on Presbury Street, which we'll always refer to as Stop 1. According to the timeline, Freddie fled on foot after being approached by officers at 8:39 and 12 seconds. That's the timestamp on Lieutenant Rice's first call to dispatch, which you just heard. He was taken into custody at 8:40 and 12 seconds, which is when Nero or Miller, it's not clear which, radioed to dispatch to say, "We got one." At 8:42 and 52 seconds, quote, "the arresting officers requested a prisoner transport wagon." Remember, as of April 16th, BPD officials were still being cagey about what Freddie had even been arrested for. What were they waiting for? Well, that's a subject we'll be tackling in a little bit. Additional details about Stop 1 were otherwise scarce, though both Commissioner Anthony Batts and Deputy Commissioner Rodriguez did go out of their way to mention that Freddie asked for his inhaler. Quote, "as Gray was loaded into a transport wagon, he asked for an inhaler, but police did not have one," Rodriguez said matter-of-factly. Batts was a little more verbose, as usual.
"He asked for the inhaler as he was going into. At one or two of the stops, it was noticed that he was having a little trouble breathing, where we should have probably asked for paramedics or had him look at that time."
A rare moment when someone from BPD command suggests that their officers might have done something wrong. Remember, April 20th was also the day that BPD suspended the six officers who would eventually be charged. Still, you gotta wonder if everyone back at headquarters appreciated Batts being so candid. On April 24th, BPD uploaded footage from 16 CityWatch CCTV cameras to their YouTube page. This was after that press conference we told you about during our last episode, the one where Batts Rodriguez and Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake whispered about what camera can and cannot be out there. Three of the cameras survey Gilmore Homes and caught Freddie's arrest on Presbury Street. Well, sort of.
It is time for the most delicious moment in our podcast, y'all. That's right, I'm going to tell you about how wonderful Blue Apron is. Here is your recipe this week. Oh, disclaimer. Grab a napkin, because you might start drooling when you hear this. We've got pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple, vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips, and spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice. Of course, we love Blue Apron because it's delicious, but that's not the only reason. We love Blue Apron because we care about a more sustainable food system. We care about high standards for ingredients. We care about being part of a community of home chefs who use seafood that's sourced sustainably, pork that's raised naturally, and chickens that are raised free range. Listen, you're doing your palate, your stomach, and your health a disservice by eating anything else. So go get Blue Apron. You're going to spend $10 or less per person for a healthy, delicious meal. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
For simplicity's sake, since there are a lot of cameras to talk about over the next few episodes, we're going to give them our own numbering system based on stop. All the footage will be uploaded to our website, and there will be maps for all the stops showing where each camera is located. Also, you're going to hear a bunch of timestamps for the next few episodes. We mention them because they're important to understanding the events of that morning. But don't feel like you need to take notes or anything. This isn't school. Transcripts of every episode will be on the site, so if you decide to review the footage yourself, you can refer back. So, let's give you the lay of the land first. The streets that surround Gilmore Homes are as follows: Presbury Street to the north, Mount Street to the east, Baker Street to the south, and Bruce Street to the west. The housing project is comprised of six buildings, three on the Presbury side and three on the Baker Street side. Bakebury Court cuts from north to south through the right side of Gilmore Homes, while Bruce Court does the same thing on the left side. We will mostly refer to them as entrances. For example, there is now a memorial to Freddie Gray on the wall near the Bakebury Court entrance to Gilmore Homes. Let's start with the camera closest to where Freddie was detained. CCTV camera 2101, which we'll be calling Cam 1A, is affixed to the upper left building of Gilmore Homes above the Bruce Court entrance and rotates from right to left on Presbury Street. At 8:39 and 59 seconds, as the camera pans left, Freddie appears at the corner of Mount and Presbury, flanked by Officer Garrett Miller on his bike in the street. Less than a second later, they're out of view, and Bruce Street, which intersects with Presbury and then continues behind Gilmore Homes, has entered the frame. At 8:40 and 4 seconds, Officer Edward Nero can be seen riding down Bruce Street, and less than a second later, he's out of the frame too. At 8:40 and 12 seconds, the officers notified dispatch that they had someone in custody.
We got one.
Unfortunately, Cam 1A was conveniently panning left and then down when Freddie gave himself up just a few feet away. But by the time Cam 1A faces right on Presbury again at 8:40 and 21 seconds, Miller and Freddie are not on screen. Nero is there, though. He can always be identified as the skinnier of the two white-helmeted bike cops. Nero is between the railings of a handicap ramp at the Bruce Court entrance to the housing project, and he's getting on a bike, the same bike he was on the last time we saw him, 15 seconds before. Here's what Cam 1A apparently missed, according to Officer Miller, when he testified at Nero's trial. Freddie initially ran into the Bakebury Court entrance to Gilmore Homes, with Miller just behind him on his bike. Freddie quickly doubled back out onto Presbury Street, leading Miller to drop his bike to pursue him on foot. Miller yelled, "Taser, taser, taser," and pulled the device from his holster, but said he did not deploy it. Freddie started to run into the Bruce Court entrance to Gilmore Homes via the handicap ramp, but upon seeing Nero at the other end, finally surrendered. Remember, only 22 seconds before, Freddie's feet and Miller's bike were just hitting the corner of Presbury and Mount. And 17 seconds before, Nero was still a good 150 feet up Bruce Street. That means a whole lot of action went down during a 10 to 15 second window, and all while Cam 1A was pointed in the opposite direction. This is not the only CCTV camera that conveniently missed Freddie's detainment. 2106, or Cam 1B, which is positioned on the upper right building at the Bakebury Court entrance to Gilmore Homes, and 2104, or Cam 1C, positioned on the bottom center building on the Baker Street side, they did too. Unfortunately, this bit of bad timing isn't an anomaly. There are other examples of these three cameras and many of the others somehow missing key moments that were presented as fact by the Baltimore Police Department and later by the state's attorneys at trial. Prepare yourself. There are going to be a lot of questions that start with, why didn't the CCTV cameras ... for the next few episodes? There are other cameras that were working that morning too that we haven't seen. 44 cameras in total were on the state's initial discoveries list, and 18 were listed as state's evidence at trial. 2107, or Cam 1D, for example, is located across the street from Gilmore Homes on Mount Street near Vincent Court. It was withheld by the police and prosecution, save for a single minute that was included as part of a compilation BPD also uploaded to YouTube. Cam 1D has a clear view up Mount Street and down Presbury Street to the left, and could have caught the last part of the foot chase as well as Freddie's detainment. Alas, Cam 1D has never been made public, but some of the footage was included in a CCTV montage at trial. From what we could gather from the way it was utilized and described in court, Cam 1D captured a few extra seconds of Freddie pounding the pavement on Presbury, but lo and behold, managed to just miss whatever happened next. What luck, huh?
Here's what a surface-level assessment of the footage from Cam 1A, 1B, and 1C, as well as the police dispatch audio and the accounts given by officers, could tell us about the rest of Stop 1. After Freddie was detained, Miller took him somewhere within the courtyard out of view of any CCTV cameras. Nero apparently rode his bike from the railing into the other side of Gilmore Homes, where he's next seen on Cam 1B walking both his bike and Miller's bike back towards Presbury Street at 8:40 and 45 seconds. Meanwhile, at 8:40 and 30 seconds, we get our first look at Lieutenant Rice, who suddenly appears on Cam 1A. Rice can always be identified as the bike cop with the black helmet and long black sleeves. He rides up Bruce Street and then turns right, disappearing behind the houses on Presbury, the same area where he chased Freddie, in fact. It's not clear where Rice came from. He's nowhere to be found on any of the three cameras up until this point, but this is not the first time we should be seeing him. At trial, prosecutor Michael Schatzow described CCTV footage, which allegedly shows Rice arriving on Presbury Street while Nero and Miller are supposedly apprehending Freddie on the ramp, and then turning around and going back up Bruce. Weird. At 8:40 and 52 seconds, either Nero or Miller notifies dispatch with their location. And then at 8:41 and 9 seconds, Nero alerts Lieutenant Rice. We are with him. By 8:41 and 12 seconds, Nero, Miller, and Freddie can be seen near the Bakebury Court entrance to Gilmore Homes, in front of a short ledge that bumps up against a brick wall. This space has since been turned into a permanent memorial for Freddie Gray. Both Cam 1A and Cam 1B show two police cars driving west on Presbury at 8:41 and 10 seconds. At least one briefly pulls up next to the arrest scene, but it's not clear if the second did too. 10 seconds later, another police car rolls up to the Fulton Street intersection and turns left. Officer Zachary Novak is at the wheel. He testified that after checking to see if Nero and Miller needed assistance, he did a loop around the block and then parked on Mount Street where Lieutenant Rice had requested backup.
Officers Mark Gladhill and William Porter also radio dispatch that they're on their way. Porter is one of the defendants in this case, but Novak and Gladhill are among several more officers who were present at one or more stops but were not charged. Lieutenant Rice is apparently searching for the other suspect, who we can only assume to be Devontae Rory.
This has never made sense. Rice followed Freddie into the cut during the foot chase and perhaps didn't see where Devontae ran. But there's no way Miller could have missed him racing ahead into Gilmore Homes. Even if he did, why would Rice think Devontae is behind the row houses where he chased Freddie? Wouldn't he have seen him back there? At 8:41 and 33 seconds, we get our look at Miller, Nero, and Freddie on Cam 1B. Freddie is sitting up with his head down. Miller is standing behind him, touching him in some way, while Nero stands in front, observing. When we see them again on this cam at 8:42 and 29 seconds, Freddie is lying face down on the ground, and Miller is either kneeling or sitting on him. Nero is crouching next to Freddie, touching his neck or upper back. Across the street, a man stands in the doorway to one of the houses on Presbury. He'll remain there until stop one is over. At 8:42 and 37 seconds, witness Kevin Moore, one of Freddie's friends, appears in the middle of Presbury Street and immediately begins filming with his cell phone.
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates the exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And I can say as a user, I am working on cases in so many different states now and using the mail for both personal and professional reasons, and Stamps.com makes life so easy. And now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage, and a digital scale without long-term commitments. So go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
BPD released a few other CCTV cameras located down Mount Street, but for different time spans. Footage from CCTV 2128, or Cam 1E, at Mount Street and Lorman Court overlaps with the timing of the arrest. It's on this footage at 8:41 and 40 seconds that we first see the transport van being driven by Officer Caesar Goodson. Its lights and sirens are on, clearly headed towards the scene. A few blocks north, the transport van shows up again on Cam 1C at 8:42 and 8 seconds. It is now just one block away from stop one. There's just one small problem. No one has requested a transport wagon yet. Not on the police radio, at least, which is how it's supposed to be done. That won't happen for another 47 seconds after Goodson has already driven through the intersection of Presbury and Mount. Here's the audio for that request, which happened between 8:42 and 55 seconds and 8:43 and 18 seconds.
Hey, give us a wagon quick.
91. 10-4.
Hey, no, this is actually Bruce. Hey, Bruce Court. Hi, 10-4. 710 request me. Let's get a wagon. Come on, start empty out.
91's on the way.
91, I'm right here on Mouse Street, 70 in the mouth.
So when Goodson, a.k.a. Unit 91, says he's en route at 8:43, he's already arrived. Only he's responded to the location where Lieutenant Rice had requested backup. I'm not just guessing either. You can literally see the rear of the transport van parked on Mount Street on Cam 1B at that exact time. It's easy to miss it on the footage itself, but Goodson is directly within the bike cop's line of sight. If the timestamps on the dispatch audio and the CCTV footage are accurate, then the bike cops should have been able to see the van when they made their second request at 8:43 and 11 seconds. There's been no explanation for why the transport van was headed to the scene with lights and sirens before being called, or why Goodson didn't just say he was spitting distance away when he did get the request for a wagon. Seriously, he could have just leaned out the window and shouted, "Hey guys, be right there." That's how close he was. Instead, the transport van didn't arrive on scene for another 30 seconds. There are other strange, unexplained moments on the CCTV footage from Stop 1. Besides the transport van's mysterious early arrival, the one that perplexes me the most can be seen on Cam 1B at 8:43 and 4 seconds. The camera is rotated away from the arrest and is pointed at the upper right corner of Mountain Presbury, where there's an unobstructed view of three uniformed police officers walking around behind one of the Mount Street houses. Their heads are down and they are very clearly searching the ground for something. 1707 Mount, the location where Rice said he was searching for a second suspect, is just up the street. But remember, we last saw Rice disappearing behind the houses on Presbury. Maybe he went back out onto Mount Street and actually was searching behind 1707? Who knows? But he's definitely never seen anywhere near the lot where the uniformed cops are. I've walked through that lot, by the way. There's nowhere for a person to hide. Unless Rice has reason to believe that Devontae Rory shapeshifted into a gopher, why would they be searching the ground anyway? The most obvious conclusion here is that the three cops were looking for some sort of discarded contraband, like drugs or a weapon, but whose? Besides, wasn't Freddie Gray already under arrest? Logic suggests that the three uniformed cops are officers Novak, Gladhill, and Porter, since they responded to Rice's backup call. But I feel fairly confident saying that two of the cops are Novak and Gladhill. But not because they said so. In fact, Gladhill maintains in both his recorded statement to detectives on April 24th, and then again while testifying at Porter's trial, that when he arrived at the 1700 block of Mount Street, he never got out of his car. But the police dispatch suggests otherwise. We don't have an exact timestamp for this call, but after the wagon is requested and before Goodson alerts dispatch that he's leaving Stop 1, Gladhill asks, "Do you need me in the rear anymore?" We haven't gotten a hold of the two statements Officer Novak gave to investigators, but he testified that he drove past the arrest and did a loop around the block. He parked up on Mount Street and helped search for the second suspect. Since that's the only search that's ever acknowledged, I'll assume Novak meant that he was gopher hunting. But Officer Porter can't be in the lot with Novak and Gladhill because at that exact time, he can be seen walking down Bruce Street on Cam 1A. So who is the third uniformed cop? He's kind of a mystery. I mean, I know his name, Ricardo Alvarado Rivera, a rookie cop who no longer works for BPD. I didn't even know he existed when I first started investigating the case, let alone that he was one of the involved officers. He didn't testify at any of the trials, he was never referenced in a single news article, and most importantly, he's never heard on the police dispatch. I found his name on a random internet forum in an article about possible defense witnesses that had been copy-pasted from WBAL radio. For some reason, his name doesn't appear in the original article on their website. A couple weeks later, I came across his name again in one of the case files. He was listed with Novak, Gladhill, and two other officers, Matthew Wood and Aaron Jackson, as having provided backup that morning. Alvarado and the four other cops that were not charged in Freddie's death were given immunity by the state's attorney's office. So if Porter wasn't gopher hunting, what did he do upon arriving at Stop 1?
In his official statement 5 days later, Porter said that he parked near Bruce and Westwood Street, one block north of Presbury, and was between Mount Street and Fulton Street for about 8 minutes. That's impossible, based on the official timeline and the CCTV timestamps. Stop one lasted a little over 6 minutes, and by his own account, Porter didn't show up until 3 minutes had already passed. Porter, as you'll soon learn, has a tendency to exaggerate when left to his own devices, and especially when he's under pressure. At trial, Porter's story was a little closer to what's seen on the footage. He testified that he parked on Westwood and was walking down Bruce Street when he saw Lieutenant Rice. They had a conversation, and he proceeded to help search for the second suspect behind the houses on Presbury. But that's not quite right either. Porter does appear to see someone, but ahead of him, somewhere within the Gilmore Homes courtyard. He even gestures like he's acknowledging some sort of signal. Then he turns around, walks back up Bruce Street, and disappears behind the houses on Presbury, where we last saw Rice go. Did Rice teleport to the courtyard within Gilmore Homes? Or was Porter signaling to somebody else? And if so, who? What made him double back up Bruce and behind the Presbury houses? And where did this conversation with Rice happen? So many questions, very few answers. And not to throw another wrench into the mix, but here we are. Officer Gladhill says in both his statement and his trial testimony that he actually followed Porter's car over to Presbury Street. He's got an explanation for it, too. Normally assigned to Sector 1 or 2, which are further south, Gladhill wasn't as familiar with Sector 3 as Porter, and he wasn't sure how to get from 1700 Mount to 1700 Presbury, so he followed him. One block. Gladhill, as you'll soon learn, isn't the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Whatever the uniformed cops were searching for, they gave up quickly because the lot is empty on Cam 1B's next rotation at 8:43 and 55 seconds, and Alvarado is crossing the intersection toward Gilmore Homes. Novak and Gladhill beat him to the scene by 10 seconds. Cam 1A shows Novak arriving on foot and Gladhill getting out of his vehicle at the same time as the transport van is turning onto Presbury Street. There are at least 10 witnesses watching the scene, and Kevin Moore is still filming. Brandon Ross, Freddie's friend who didn't run, is just getting there too. Even though he's a blurry speck in the distance, you can tell by his pace and his body language that he's upset about what he sees. Novak testified that he ran over to Presbury Street after a 1016 was issued over dispatch. Police use what are called 10 codes in order to quickly and efficiently communicate. 1016 is an urgent request for backup. Contrary to Novak's testimony, there are no 1016s or urgent backup requests in any form on the police audio during stop one. Huh. Things only happen more quickly from there. At 8:44 and 12 seconds on both Cam 1A and Cam 1B, the van is parked in the Bakebury Court entrance to Gilmore Homes. The back doors are open and Nero and Novak are already loading Freddie into the van. Kevin Moore's cell phone video captured this moment, and a still photo labeled with the officers' names was used by multiple media outlets, but with one major mistake. Officer Novak is identified as Lieutenant Rice. Rice, the commanding officer who got this whole thing started by chasing Freddie seemingly without cause, who never communicated the reason he should be detained to Nero or Miller, has not been seen since he disappeared behind the houses on Presbury. Finally, at 8:44 and 25 seconds, Lieutenant Rice pedals down Bruce Street toward the scene. He's been gone for nearly 4 minutes. On Cam 1A's next rotation, the van doors are shut with Freddie Gray inside. Lieutenant Rice is shooing away bystanders. Novak has already left, and Officer Jackson, who just showed up, is strolling in the street. Porter only shows up that one time on the CCTV footage from stop one, but he was apparently doing crowd control on Mount Street. At 8:46:01, the transport van turns right onto Presbury, departing stop one. At 8:46 and 12 seconds, 11 seconds later, dispatch is notified.
1 mile from Cynthian Presbury to Western District.
10-4.
Western District is 4 blocks away. It'll take the transport van over 35 minutes to get there. The CCTV footage and officer accounts of stop one would lead anyone to believe that this was just another arrest that attracted a small crowd of onlookers. Those witnesses say otherwise.
Thank you.
They say that taking a much-needed vacation could add years to your life. Rad, I'm into that. What I'm not so into is how overwhelming it can be to plan a vacation. All that stands between me, a hammock, and a tropical beach nap is a mountain of research. Who has the time? There has to be an easier way. So if you want to take the stress out of vacation planning, let me tell you about Tripping.com. There's no better place than Tripping.com to find your perfect vacation rental. Tripping.com gives you direct access to over 10 million properties, pulling from Vrbo, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and dozens of other sites. Find the widest selection of vacation rentals all around the world, all in one place. Tripping.com's comprehensive search allows you to easily compare prices, locations, and amenities. Awesome. And you can relax knowing that you're getting the best price for your rental. In fact, you'll save an average of 18% per night when you book with Tripping.com. Cha-ching! Visit tripping.com/undisclosed today to start and finish the search for your perfect vacation rental. That's tripping.com/undisclosed. Tripping.com/undisclosed.
In the 28th chapter of the book of Proverbs, the very first verse reads, "The wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are as bold as a lion." This maxim forms the philosophical basis supporting a police officer's right to pursue a suspect who runs away from the law unprovoked. Which takes us to the vital question of just exactly why were the police chasing Freddie Gray? What we've known for the most part that it was simply because he saw the cops and started running. Now, there's been a lot of discussion in the media, but little clarity about whether it was okay for the officers involved to pursue Freddie Gray just because they saw him running, and not just in the Freddie Gray case. We see, especially online, people defending an officer's actions to stop a suspect or run after them, usually a black man, when he or she runs away. No one runs unless they're hiding something, is their rationale. And in this case, when the trial stage was reached, defense counsel for the officers argued that there was no question the officers were well within their legal right to chase Freddie on foot. So let's examine that, shall we? The legal test to meet is articulated in Illinois v. Wardlow, a 1997 case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, which was determining whether the evidence collected by officers against a suspect who fled after seeing them was actually collected constitutionally. See, if the chase itself was unlawful, any evidence found on the suspect wouldn't be admissible against him. In this case, the cops caught Wardlow, patted him down, and found a .38 caliber gun on him. Wardlow was convicted of the unlawful use of a weapon by a felon, a conviction that the Supreme Court of Illinois actually overturned because they found that the seizure of the weapon by cops was a result of an unauthorized and illegal stop that didn't meet the reasonable suspicion standards of another precedent, Terry v. Ohio, which we'll get into. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't agree with the highest court in Illinois, and they reversed their decision. Ultimately, they found that it was the totality of the circumstances that determined whether a foot chase was warranted. In this case, they cited Wardlow's, quote, unprovoked flight, in addition to being in a high-crime area, which gave officers reasonable suspicion to chase, stop, and frisk him. In Maryland, courts have held that the chase must be predicated on more than, quote, a mere hunch, but less than probable cause. So what does that mean for Freddie Gray and the officers chasing him? Did they meet the Wardlow standard? According to the initial report filed by Officer Miller, quote, 12 April 2015, at 1700 block of Presbury Street, Baltimore, Maryland, the above-named defendant fled unprovoked upon noticing police presence. So you've got unprovoked flight in the report, coupled with much of downtown Baltimore being considered a high-crime area by courts. Well, it seems like a cut-and-dry legal foot chase. But here are a few problems with that.
These cases often neglect the most important thing. Well, the most important thing to me, history. Although the courts take into account the criminal history of the communities in which people are targeted, which is the basis of the designation of a high crime area, there's no way to capture the long-standing fears that some people have of police. And rarely in conversations about probable cause and questionable arrest do we hear any insights about why people flee when they see the police. As Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Betts stated after Freddie was killed, there's no law against running. But there have been laws on the books regulating where black people could go, sit, lean, use the bathroom, eat, sleep, how they were to drive, to walk on sidewalks when whites were sharing the street, and so on and so on. And the police have played an important role in upholding these rules and regulations of race. Although the Supreme Court legally abolished segregation, or separate but equal, in 1954, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was supposed to make sure it was implemented in all public places, these legal protections didn't change the memories of police abuse. It didn't change the stories told and retold about police threatening or using force against Black communities, and it didn't put an end to harassment and intimidation. So when a person sees a police officer and flees the scene, they may be reacting to the past as much as the present. And here's another reason to deeply consider why the finding in Wardlow may be, though legal, simply unethical and discriminatory: the designation of a high crime area. A recent Maryland case found when the character of the high crime area is then combined with unprovoked flight upon noticing the arrival of the police, critical mass has been reached. Well, guess what? Most of the city of Baltimore is considered a high crime area, and this determination is reached through the testimony of police officers themselves. Quite a self-serving loophole that puts entire communities and neighborhoods on the defensive. I have to wonder, though, if a young Black man was found in what could be considered a low crime area, example, a white suburban neighborhood, and fled unprovoked, would the average police officer decide, well, the Wardlow standard isn't met here, so I guess I can't chase him? Anyhow, we're talking about Sandtown, and in this case, even the state stipulated that the entire neighborhood is considered a high crime area. That means every resident or person passing through already has one strike against them.
We spoke with Seth Stoughton, associate professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and former police officer, who publishes extensively on police training and practice. He discussed criticism of the Supreme Court's Wardlow decision.
High crime area has no precise legal meaning. In fact, generally, courts allow the prosecution to establish that a particular area is a high crime area by having officers testify about the number and types of crimes in that area. It's a pretty vague standard, and it's vague on at least two different levels. The first is what counts as high. What separates a high crime area from a moderate crime area or a low crime area? There's no clear guidance on that. There's no clear guidance on whether, for example, an area that has high seasonal crime, say a lot of crime over the summer, but low winter crime, counts as a high crime area in winter. We have no idea, which means the answer tends to be yes, it does count as a high crime area. The other part that's rather vague is what counts as area. For example, in the Floyd litigation in New York, the litigation on the New York Police Department Stop, Question, Frisk program, the district court judge, Judge Shinlin, asked whether the relevant area for a high crime area would include a particular neighborhood or the entire borough of Brooklyn or maybe the entire state of New York. And as a result of that vagueness, what tends to happen is officers can testify that they are active in a particular area, that it is known for a particular amount or type of crime, and based on their training and experience, they identify this area as a high crime area.
Then there is this. Both Brandon and Devontae, the friends who were with Freddie Gray that morning, say that he was already running before he even noticed Officer Rice. And like many of you, I'm not sure exactly what to make of that statement. Why was he running? Did he have to get somewhere quickly? Was he out for a jog? What was going on? But if he was indeed running before ever seeing the police, this makes a difference in the legality of the chase. In order to meet the Wardlow standard, which is, quote, unprovoked fleeing, you actually have to be fleeing, meaning you could be running from the police in order for them to find it suspicious. You can't just be out for a run in the vicinity of the police, because there's nothing suspicious about that. Anyway, at the end of the day, the official version of events did not include Brandon and Devontae's accounts, so the chase was considered legal at trial.
officers can pick and choose whom they stop in a high crime area. Officers can engage in tactics that are designed in some form to get people to run to establish reasonable suspicion. So, for example, a caravan of officers might come screaming up into a neighborhood, and the officers might stop and jump out and see who runs. And when people run, they immediately have reasonable suspicion, if it's a high crime area, to command that person to stop. And if the person doesn't stop, in most states, you actually have a crime being committed. You have something like resisting or failing to obey the lawful order of a police officer.
So now we go from the chase to the actual detention of Freddie Gray, which is an entirely different issue. The 1968 case, Terry versus Ohio, set the legal standard that has to be met today when a police officer makes something called a Terry stop, also known as a stop and frisk. Generally speaking, an officer can't just stop someone without, quote, probable cause, as it's commonly known. But a Terry stop is different. In Terry v. Ohio, the court found that officers could stop and search subjects without probable cause and do a limited search for weapons on that person if the officer felt his safety or the safety of others was in jeopardy. The search has to be limited, and the officer can't just go digging into people's pockets or belongings unless an initial pat-down gives them reason to suspect the person is carrying a weapon. But the officer also can't just do the pat-down without something called reasonable, articulable suspicion. In the Maryland case, Simpler v. State, the court found that when an arrest happens that doesn't involve violence or huge quantities of drugs, the officer has to have another reason, that reasonable, articulable suspicion, to conduct a pat-down. And that pat-down can later lead to that officer maybe reaching inside a pocket to search further. In order to meet that standard, the officer can question the person, and if they're acting suspicious or weird, they can briefly detain them and pat them down. Other reasons an officer could do a pat-down and Terry stop is if they see the individual make a sudden move towards a pocket, or if they see a very obvious and identifiable bulge of a weapon.
It's important to realize and unpack the Supreme Court's view of police. When it's describing what police do and the powers that they need to be able to do it, the Supreme Court has a very positive view of police. Police as serving and protecting the community, as ferreting out crime, as intervening before a criminal can victimize someone. And that's something that it's pretty easy to get behind. But it doesn't always play out quite so positively in practice.
So what does the Constitution have to say about when a police officer can stop and search you? The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution states that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Straightforward. Of course not. Since the Terry v. Ohio case in 1968, which affirmed the right of a police officer to stop and frisk three men for acting suspiciously in front of a Cleveland jewelry store, the Supreme Court has increasingly interpreted the Fourth Amendment as giving latitude to police officers to search motorists and pedestrians alike based on suspicious or questionable behavior. The sticking point is, what does it mean to act suspiciously? Pacing, standing too still, looking nervous, looking too calm, all fit within the frame of unusual conduct, as it's called in Terry v. Ohio. Most people are familiar with the term stop and frisk, rather than the Supreme Court case that protects it. During the 2016 presidential election, then-candidate Donald Trump misinformed the public when he said a New York judge ended the practice and that it led to an increase in murders in New York City. First things first. Stop and frisk is clearly constitutional, but U.S. District Court Judge Shira Scheinlin said that the way that the New York City Police Department was exercising stop and frisk, specifically in their racial profiling and targeting of people of color, particularly Black and Latino people, was in fact unconstitutional. Judge Scheinlin's ruling was based on the fact that between 2004 and 2012, there were 4.4 million, yes, million, stops in New York City. More than 80% of them were targeting Black and Latino people who had committed no crime. Mind you, only 52% of the city is Black or Latino. So what was the conclusion in the case, Floyd versus the City of New York, the stop and frisk case? Scheinlin ordered remedies, not the end of stop and frisk, including change to certain policies and activities of the NYPD, the use of body cameras in one precinct per bureau, community-based remediation programs, and an independent monitor of the NYPD's searches. So while stop and frisk is protected by the Constitution, its use is also up to individual mayors and chiefs of police who have to decide whether this policy hurts or helps the citizens they govern. According to the New York Times, by the end of 2013, the year the ruling was made, the number of stops declined by 72%. The crime rate also declined. While Trump suggested that stop and frisk was a tool to stop violent crime, the majority of arrests that resulted from stop and frisk were possession of marijuana, not guns, and there is no evidence that these stops stopped anyone from committing homicide. In that Justice Department report on the Baltimore Police Department I mentioned in Episode 1, stop and frisk also comes up. In one of the report's sections, titled BPD Makes Unconstitutional Arrests, the Justice Department found a pervasive problem with arrests being made without probable cause. Arrests of people who are lawfully present on Baltimore streets, the practice of detaining individuals for investigation, effectively arresting them without probable cause, unconstitutional stops, searches, and arrests, prioritizing zero-tolerance policies that led to the harassment of community members, but not the reduction in crime, and deficient policies, trainings, and oversight.
Support for Undisclosed comes from Audible, presenting Ponzi Supernova. This original audio documentary series tells the story you think you know. Bernie Madoff, legendary fraudster, is sent to prison for orchestrating the largest Ponzi scheme in history. But that's definitely not the full story. Hosted by distinguished journalist Steve Fishman, the series features never-before-heard recordings of Madoff, drawn from hours of unheard conversations with Bernie behind bars, as well as dozens of new interviews with FBI and SEC agents, attorneys, traders, financial investors, and victims of Madoff's devastating scheme. Ponzi Supernova takes you on a fascinating journey into the dark interior of our financial system. Ponzi Supernova is a 6-part Audible original series and is available on channels. Don't forget, Audible content includes more than 325,000 audio programs from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. To listen, go to audible.com/Ponzi. By the way, Audible and Amazon Prime members listen for free. So check it out. That's audible.com/Ponzi.
A major focus of the state's attorney's case against Officer Nero was his failure to execute an appropriate Terry stop. A Terry stop is supposed to be a brief pat-down. You're not supposed to handcuff, move, and pin down a suspect, as the officers did with Freddie, before identifying criminal behavior. But it's not that simple in this case. The defense called former Assistant State's Attorney Michelle Martin, who is said to have trained Nero at the police academy, on this issue. Well, that was up for dispute, if she really trained him or not. I'll spare you the tedium of that issue. Anyway, Martin confirmed that a Terry stop is supposed to be temporary and without force, but the rules are ambiguous. She left room for the judgment of officers based on their perception of their safety. The Supreme Court consistently leaves such room for cops. It seemed like the prosecution could have gone after this issue harder. They relied on the testimony of a retired Baltimore police director of training, an esteemed expert in policy and practice, but not a legal expert in the constitutionality of arrests. I might have referred them to Professor Seth Stoughton for one, quoted earlier in this episode. The prosecution made another case about the Terry stop that was more successful in our opinion. Rice called out the chase, they said, but never told Miller or Nero why. Terry requires reasonable suspicion before you stop someone. Rice had it, legally. Freddie was fleeing his presence in a high-crime area. But Miller didn't detain Freddie based on that suspicion. Miller and Nero never took the time to radio back to Rice and ask what the suspicion was. They found their own reason for arresting Freddie, a knife on his person, but it may have been fruit from the poisonous tree of an illegal Terry stop. But there's another reason why this argument didn't work, a problem that is arguably the major flaw in the state's prosecution of Nero, namely that Nero didn't arrest Freddie Gray. Yeah, this is a big issue. Officer Miller arrested Freddie Gray. Miller stopped him, detained him, handcuffed him, moved him. Miller filed charges against him. Nero helped. The state pointed to where Nero used "we" in his statements to describe their behavior. They argued a joint arrest, but the evidence didn't support it. The defense argued teamwork. The illegal arrest argument was better suited for the case against Miller, but Miller's case was dismissed before it went to trial.
It's a lot of things that go on in this neighborhood that is unnecessary. Everybody in this neighborhood is not breaking the law. You know, true, it's crime around here, but it's crime all over, everywhere. I don't care where you go, in what city you go in, there is a crime being committed. They don't try to have any rapport with the people. They don't come around here and try to do anything to help anybody. When they come for violence to arrest somebody. So that man wasn't hurt in that van. He was hurt right there on that curb. So they trying to cover up, cover their asses. That's exactly what happened. And ain't nobody crazy. They crazy to think we crazy.
The Baltimore Police Department investigation into the death of Freddie Gray lasted 2 weeks, and the slow trickle of information about the various stops and how and why Freddie died only made it seem like more of a mystery. But to people in Sandtown, especially those who witnessed what happened at Gilmore Homes, the answer was obvious from the very beginning. The truth was on the internet, heard in Freddie's screams, and seen in his limp legs on the cell phone videos shot by Kevin Moore and Kiana Craddock. More than that, though, the truth, they say, lives in their memories of what they saw that morning, and nothing, not the police officer's statements or the CCTV footage or any of the other so-called evidence, can change that. They believed, and still do, that Freddie's neck was broken there, on the street, in front of their eyes, and not in any van. More than a dozen people of varying ages gave their accounts or simply identified themselves as witnesses to the media during the two-week BPD investigation. Most used their full names. A few of them were visited by detectives and gave statements. Others didn't or wouldn't. But the vast majority of witnesses never even heard from the state's attorney's office, despite giving damning quotes like these. "He was running. He stopped and walked towards them," Danielle Holloway told CNN. "As he was walking towards them, they proceeded to just throw him on the ground. He's lying on his back, and they flipped him over and put both knees on his back," Willie Rooks told CNN's Miguel Marquez. "He was holding the handcuffs too tight. I got asthma. Kiana Craddock told the New York Times that she saw officers sitting on Freddie's back and having his leg twisted. "I heard him howling. I heard him screaming, 'My leg, my leg,'" James Brown told The Guardian. "I saw them dragging him towards the van. They shoved him in head first." "The medical emergency was when they beat him up," Dwayne Day told ABC Baltimore. "He had his coffee in his hand. He dropped his coffee right there. He stopped right there by that pole right there, put his hands up as he's surrendering. The police straight hit him in the mouth, slammed him, put the cuffs on him, tased him." This last witness, Dwayne Day, he's one of the only people we know of who actually witnessed the moment Freddie was apprehended. His account certainly contradicts BPD's claim that Freddie was taken into police custody without force or incident. We haven't had any luck tracking Dwayne Day down, and since he was never called to testify, we don't know what other details he might have to share. He's one of the many people we hope will contact us. Someone else we'd like to talk to, who apparently did see what the CCTV cameras missed on Presbury Street? Freddie's friend and companion on North Avenue that morning, Devontae Rory. Remember, Devante also ran from Lieutenant Rice, but because of Freddy's detour, he ended up ahead of him and managed to evade capture and darted into one of the buildings at the bottom of Gilmore Homes. Until recently, I just sort of assumed that Devante hid inside a friend's apartment until he could be sure the coast was clear. He only ever gave one interview after Freddy's death, to the Baltimore Sun, but he didn't really have much to say about the actual incident. That makes sense, I thought. He wouldn't have seen anything anyway. But according to Jamel Baker, that's not the case at all. Jamel, as you'll recall from last week's episode, was a good friend of Freddy's and a prosecution witness. Jamel witnessed Stop 2 from his bedroom window, but he was otherwise clueless about where and why Freddy was arrested in the first place. A little later that morning, before anyone knew that Freddy had been hospitalized, Jamel actually ran into Devante. He had plenty to say.
He told me the same day, like after, because I never knew, I didn't know, like, the seriousness of the situation, because I was in the house, like, they was outside, and then that happened, Van left, so I'm thinking maybe, you know, we'll see him later, you know, and when I see my other homeboy, he like, yo, you should have seen what they did to Pep, yo. Because he said he kept running, but by the time he got down here, he said he stopped and he just was looking, you know, just seeing what they was going to do. He said he ran. He stopped, put his hands up. And he said one of the cops, the bike cop, just put his knee in his back and bent them up like a pretzel.
Up there at the arrest? Yeah. Did he kind of show you where he put the knee?
Yeah, he was like in right here in the top.
Right up here?
Yeah. And he said he pulled back on him.
So he was down on the ground like this.
No, he said he put his hands on his head, got on his knees, and then the cop, I guess he rushed over there, put his knee in his back and pulled back on him.
Oh.
Yeah, so.
Interesting, okay.
So I was kind of upset because I know he probably was, I think he was locked up at the time of the trial and everything. But I wish he could have, you know.
Devante was only in jail during the first trial, but that wouldn't have precluded him from testifying in court. After all, besides Jamel, the only other civilian witness from Gilmore Homes to testify was Brandon Ross, and he was in jail during 3 out of the 4 trials. But that's a whole nother story for a later episode. Witness Harold Perry didn't see the initial takedown, but he did hear it. We introduced you to Harold last week. He lives across from Gilmore Homes near the corner of Presbury and Mount. Harold is legally blind and walks with a cane, but he can still make out colors and shapes. He was channel surfing for one of his favorite Sunday morning preacher shows when he heard Freddie shout, "What are you grabbing me for? I haven't done anything." Harold looked out his bedroom window, could make out the two bike cops, Nero and Miller, thanks to their yellow and blue uniforms. Harold woke up his wife, who helped fill in the details.
And I saw him put him down, and his head was up on that little ledge. And they saying, well, it's no way he could have broke his neck just being on his back. Yes, it is when his head up on that ledge.
Harold is referring to the lip of the handicap ramp. He says Miller and Nero dragged Freddy into the courtyard on the Bruce Court Street side, just outside of Cam 1A's view. He was thrown face down right outside the ramp.
He was on his front. And the big guy was on his back, and the little guy was trying to twist his arm to hold him.
So his arms were like this, or his arms were like above his head?
No, he had the other one had his arm, and the other guy was trying to twist his arm behind his back. And he said, let me go. And the big guy got right on his back. That big 300-pound bicycle rider got right on his back. And he immediately screamed, get off my back, you're hurting my neck. I have asthma. I can't breathe.
Tobias Sellers, who you met in last week's episode, heard Freddie's screams from his house on Mount Street and rushed down to the corner to see what was happening. By that point, Freddie had been moved over to the Bakebury court side. Here's what he told me when I interviewed him last fall.
The boy was howling because the cop put his knees in the back of here, separating his spinal.
So you saw that they, like the knee, the guy's knee was in his neck?
And then after they took the batons and was beating on him, the boy was in so much pain. He was hollering. I got so pissed off and mad.
Did you happen to see which one had his knee in his neck?
Well, it was two of them that was on bicycle. Both of them was big.
Yeah. Okay. Both bike cops, right? Yeah.
And you know, they got your knee. Them big cop had his knee in the back of here.
Right back there?
Okay. Separating it.
Here's Alethea Booz, Tobias' sister, who came out shortly after he did.
The only thing I saw is when they threw him down mm-hmm. and put their knee in his back.
If you could, like, put on me, where do you think it was, the knee?
The knee?
Yeah.
Sure. I saw it right there. It was right in here.
Right in there. Okay. Uh-huh.
Like, you know, like you stoop on something on your back. Let me see. She do it. Yeah, like that. Yes. And he was hollering, you know. And when they went to get that boy up, he could not walk. He was hurt right there at that wall.
Mm-hmm. Alethea and Tobias both talked about seeing Officer Porter arrive. He was familiar to them, having worked in the neighborhood plenty of times before.
I seen the black cop came around the corner. I said, "Won't you do something about that?" He ignored me, walked on down the street. I said, "That motherfucker."
When we asked him to help, I said, "What, are you scared? Help him. He needs help. He needs to go to hospital. He's hurt." He ignored us.
Kevin Moore lives a few yards away from where Freddie was detained. He was woken up by his uncle yelling from the courtyard that Freddie was being tased. By the time Kevin got outside, Miller and Nero had moved Freddie over to the Bakebury Court side of Gilmore Homes. Here's what he told the Baltimore Sun.
Before I hit the corner, I heard the taser, but I couldn't record it because I was still in the backside. But once I got around to see where Freddie was, I instantly started recording, and I pulled my camera out. I couldn't get a good view from the back, so I went around the van to try to get a better angle. They had him folded up like he was a crab or like a piece of origami, you know what I mean? Like, he was all bent up, and they had his knee, the officer had their knee and his neck, and he was just screaming. He was, screaming for life, you know what I mean? He couldn't breathe. He needed an asthma pump, which he let them know. I couldn't breathe. I need an asthma pump. They ignored it. When they went to pick him up off the ground, his legs were limp.
Alethea, Tobias, and Harold all said they didn't see any knife at the scene and expressed serious doubt that the police found one on Freddie. They also recoiled at the notion that Freddie was faking his screams to get out of being arrested, a popular excuse with those who either believed Freddie was injured during a rough ride or by banging his own head in the back of the van.
He wasn't faking. He got hurt over there. He couldn't even walk. They picked him up. His feet were like this when they were walking him. Mm-hmm. They were literally dragging him. That boy was injured. If you heard his screams, you would know that this boy was in physical pain, and it wasn't no fake. I hear those screams sometime in the night. Mm-hmm. I'll wake up. My wife asks me what's wrong, and I say, I just can't sleep. I keep hearing that boy.
During our 40-minute interview, Harold told me something else that I'd never heard or read before. It turns out he's only ever made it into one published interview with a YouTube show called Real Talk with Zeb. Here's what he told me happened just after Miller and Nero took Freddie over to the Bakebury Court entrance to Gilmore Homes. A relative of his, Larry, a friend of Freddie's from growing up, chimes in at the end.
Almost in the walkway, the lieutenant jumped on his back, and the boy said, "Get off of my legs, you're hurting my back." And he told him point blank, loudly, "Shut the F up." And I said, "That's a damn shame."
Did that lieutenant, he was wearing a white shirt, did he have a helmet on too?
No, he had no helmet on. He jumped out of the car. He was driving the car. He jumped out the car, ran across the street.
So he parked right here?
Yeah, he parked right here. One parked here and the other one parked behind him, almost at the corner. And it was an African-American officer in the back. And he strode across the street. And the lieutenant ran. You heard his keys running across the street. I said, "Man, this is a damn shame."
You know, it's interesting. Have you heard about the fact that the CCTV footage or the cameras caught, you know, some of the stuff that happened that morning? But there are points. Well, there's certainly what you're describing right now is not on the footage.
I already deleted that. The footage that would have incriminated the officers, it's been deleted.
I asked Tobias about the CCTV cameras too. He said that the cops don't care. I've seen this perspective echoed in other interviews with witnesses both in this case and in other cases of police brutality, that the footage will never be on their side because the police get to it first. This shouldn't come as a surprise, but everything these witnesses have alleged in their interviews with me and the many other media outlets they've spoken to since April 12, 2015, don't appear in the CCTV footage that has been made public or shown at trial. But that does not mean it wasn't once there. That doesn't mean it did not happen.
When Freddie Gray's story hit the news 2 years ago, the nation was stunned watching the video taken at the first stop when he was detained and arrested. We all saw him being nearly dragged to the van, his hands cuffed, grimacing in pain, barely able to hold his head up. Our attention has mostly been fixated on that footage, on what happened in those moments, because we can clearly see Freddie. We can see his suffering. But because that video was so compelling, it may have distracted us from what the next stop on Freddie's last ride out of Gilmore Homes tells us. Stop 2 of the ride that ended Freddie Gray's life, next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 3, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Jason Henderson helped with research for this episode, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Methil Telhan is the super producer that brings everything together and makes sure that you get a new Undisclosed podcast every Monday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Our sponsors ensure that we can continue to fund and produce this investigation, so we want to give thanks to our sponsors as well. Really, we appreciate them a lot. Our investigation has consumed countless hours, and requests for police records and copies of court information just don't come cheap. Sponsorship helps tremendously with those costs, so let's thank Stamps.com, Tripping.com, Audible's presentation of Ponzi Supernova, and Blue Apron. We're also consumers of those products, so we proudly endorse them. Make sure you check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Musser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That's www.undisclosed-podcast.com. And Baluki does our graphics. Stop by on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Dee's ability to bring a new perspective to our investigation makes for some powerful audio. You gotta trust me on that. Moreover, you're going to get important context that we hope deepens your understanding of the world in which Mr. Gray lived. Make sure you follow Dee on Twitter at DWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag Freddie Gray and or hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...